And welcome back to Coast, Bart Costco with us. We're going to take your calls and continue chatting with him. Calls on North Korea and artificial intelligence and so much more. And welcome back, Bart Costco with us. Bart, they're experimenting now with driverless trucks. I hate that. I really do. Displacing our truck drivers. I mean, that's it. That makes no sense, does it?
Well, there's a lot of things. I don't think they're going to displace all drivers, but I'm going to say, George, I published on this back in the 90s.
Wow.
And we did an experiment once on Highway Interstate 15 in San Diego, if you know what that is, because they can block off the lanes. And in fact, what we've been looking at, what we're looking at then, I think we'll come back now, are what we call smart car platoons. Not just one car without a driver, it may have a driver, but several cars in one group, traveling in a group, much more like a packet, like a bit packet of information that travels around on the internet. And we did some simple experiments on that. One of the problems with that, by the way, is just the sheer legal liability when that inevitably goes wrong. Everybody gets sued, and the people in the different cars and the manufacturers and so many other folks. So the automating that, I think there's some merit to it. I don't think it'll ever replace all these tasks. Like we mentioned before the break, flipping burgers, and I told you I used to do that, and I was thinking about it. It's one thing to manually flip that burger. That's where your robot comes in. But what they hired me for, George, at the old Dairy Queen, was to manage the rush time at lunch and at dinner. And that was a very cognitive thing.
That's right.
Flipping burgers and 10 other things. So I don't think they changed too much. But let me tell you something else that we've long since done with Fuzzy Logic. We've backed up not just a truck, but a truck and a trailer, which is a lot more difficult task if you've ever done that. I mean, I think most of your listeners have backed up a car before, but how many have backed up a car or truck with a trailer attached?
It's not easy because it goes left and right, and it's an art. Really,
it was really an unsolved problem of nonlinear mathematical control. And my colleagues in Japan, once we knocked this out, my colleagues in Japan quickly were able to back up a truck and five trailers and so on. But in looking at that, we first, my colleagues at Stanford, Professor Bernard Widrow, was able to knock it out with a neural network, this thing I mentioned before, deep learning or back propagation. This is again in 1990, we're talking about 91. And then I was able to use a fuzzy system. By the way, I should point out, any time in theory that you have a smart system or a neural network system, we can train from it and convert that into an approximate fuzzy system. The trouble with the AI systems and neural network systems, they're black boxes. We don't know what's in them. But if you can get it converted over to a fuzzy rule-based system, it's a gray box. And we were able to do that and get it down to, I think, 30 rules. And there were some folks up at Ford Motors that got it down all the way to about 4 rules. And they would talk. We would talk to human experts to get a sense of it. But what we did more than that was simply watch them, how they would back up and see the trajectories of the truck and the trailer. And with learning algorithms, they would start to tune the fuzzy rules. First, the system was dumb, like the blind Frankenstein monster. But as it got more training, it got smarter and could back it up. There'll be a lot of that, but I don't think we'll outright replace truckers. And if we do, it won't happen anytime soon.
I hope not. But I am amazed at some of these cars that park themselves and brake themselves in the event of danger. I mean, that is amazing technology, too.
That's all of the good, I think.
Yeah, sure. So let's take some calls here for you. Let's go to Tom in Phoenix, Arizona, west of the Rockies. Hi, Tom. Go ahead.
Hi. Great show tonight.
Great. Good to have you with us.
Sounds like our truckers are going to be part computer operators.
Maybe.
Yeah. Listen, I was actually, I wanted to go with the subject of North Korea real quick.
Sure.
Over the last couple of years, I've just, you know, searching on the internet, I've occasionally found mention of two satellites that apparently, I think, were manufactured by North Korea and are above the United States. I was curious whether your guests knew anything about those.
Well, North Korea has put up a satellite, as has Iran, and it is a concern. I mean, obviously, that is setting up a lot of things. It's setting up the concern we have about ICBMs. It's setting up anti-satellite technology, something, by the way, the Chinese are very far ahead of us on, and the like. One of the things we need to do, George, we can't put weapons in space for various treaties that we have.
Right.
You'd like to have that, for example, so that right when the rocket launches.
You take them out.
Yeah. You take them out because it looks like someone lighting a match in a dark room. But what we do need more of, and we can put up, are satellite sensors. And I think a great deal of those are in order here.
And they
North Koreans are up to it, yeah.
And they report back to us instantly, so we know something's been launched, right?
Something's been launched, right, and a lot more things. And there's the new frontiers of battle, not just on the cyber front, are increasingly including deep space and the satellite level.
Iran's somewhat quiet. I mean, they're not outwardly saying we're going to attack you, we're going to launch at you. They're a little smarter, I think, than North Korea.
They are, but they have relationships with North Korea. We don't know how much they've helped them test what gadgets, for example. They have elaborate tunneling systems. You know, our agreement, such as it is, very controversial Iranian deal, does not allow us to inspect what we really want to inspect, which is their military sites. That's why we didn't know about these missiles that they launched. And we don't know what's under there, George.
No,
in fact, to my knowledge,
don't.
I'm not sure we've done any inspections at all. But make no mistake, they still have a few centrifuges left. These are centrifuges, by the way, they got from Pakistan, in particular from Dr. A.Q. Khan, the same gentleman who helped sell them to Libya and initially to Iraq. And they're taking a different path to the bomb, which is a uranium path to the bomb, something that the Chinese perfected. You know, the Chinese caught us off guard in the mid-60s when they first detonated a bomb because we thought it'd be a plutonium implosion device. And it wasn't. It was a uranium implosion device. And my understanding from the experts, this is all in the open literature, is that that's what they sell with the centrifuge technology. Real fast, the centrifuge spins gas, uranium hexafluoride gas, and it has two kinds of isotopes. It has 238 and 235.
Yeah, you can say that.
And the 238 is the much more common, 99.3% of uranium is 238, but it has three more neutrons. Than 235, the real bomb stuff. And it's being slightly heavier when you spin it. It's incredible G's on these things going around there many times per second that the heavier 238 moves to the outside of the centrifuge and the 235 on the side in the inside, and then it goes up to the top and goes on to the next one in a cascade. Now, we don't know how many centrifuges Pakistan is spinning. It could be on the order of 100,000. But as we speak, they are increasing their stockpiles, and this is, you know, with a country that indirectly supported the Taliban, that could fall the Taliban someday, and the Iranians bought their centrifuges from them, and we know that, just as I said, so did Libya and Gaddafi. In fact, apparently when Gaddafi cooperated with us and gave us the centrifuges, it included the step-by-step recipe as how to make that new Chinese all-uranium bomb. So it may be delayed by a few years here, I think at best, but we really don't know, I think, what's going on under the tunnels and mountains of Iran.
No, we don't. Why isn't Russia and China telling North Korea, do not build an atomic bomb? Don't they care?
You know, it's hard to believe that China cares since, as I heard one general say, if you scratched one of those missiles, for example, would say made in China,
and maybe so.
Right, the parts that they've been using, like the solvents and many other things that you need, take an ordinary nuclear reactor, it creates plutonium through a very simple chain reaction of uranium to neptunium to plutonium. But you have to extract that through what's called the Purex process. Well, we know that came from the Chinese. So the Chinese have been proliferators for a long time. They've worked with the Pakistanis. I'll give you another example. Back in 1998, in May of 98, during the Monica Lewinsky scandal, those days, remember that?
Sure.
And India detonated its second nuke, which hadn't in a long time. And Pakistan was upset. President Clinton apparently called the Prime Minister of Pakistan and tried his best to convince him not to test a nuke. But they did, just like 3 weeks later, also in the month of May. And the question, how could a country test a nuke that fast? And one of the many theories out there is that they had already tested it via the Chinese in their tests. It worked very closely with them. So I think, I think the Chinese have no problem from a strategic sense with the increasing stockpiles of weapons and even nuclear weapons that North Korea, its proxy, its well-funded proxy, and so in the sense that it keeps its economy online.
Go ahead. Go ahead, Bart.
Well, I think that's the concern here, that For example, if China ever did what it clearly wants to do, which is take over Taiwan, it's been amassing troops and missiles right across the Taiwan Strait for a long time.
That's what they want.
Absolutely. And all the studies I've seen indicate that we would be pinned down here, and it would be only worse having, for a lot of reasons, but only worse having a nuclear capability and cyber capability from the North Koreans. So I don't think, no matter what they say, and I know they voted a certain way on the Security Council, but it hasn't stopped, so far as we can tell, the fundamental support of not just North Korea economically, but its military program.
Your thoughts on Russia and China retaliating against us if we did something in the North?
Well, we already have information on that. Remember, China came out and said after the Guam threat in August, it said two things. It said, we won't help you, North Korea, if you attack first, but we will back you up if America attacks first.
Right.
Which is obviously the main play we're talking about.
Because exactly.
It's unlikely we're going to get attacked.
Because
George, I don't think Russia would do it, and I'm not convinced Russia is the big adversary it's often made out to be of us. I mean, it's an adversary, but, for example, it's whatever it did during the elections, and we don't know yet, it was China that hacked the federal government and took millions of federal employee security information to do who knows what kind of mischief, along with cyber hacking that takes place every day.
What would China do to retaliate? They're not going to launch nukes against us. We'll retaliate against them. I mean, it's full-scale annihilation.
No, that's we're not going to do that. But they could block some of our satellites. They could do cyber attacks. They could interfere with our logistics. They could do a lot of things to mute our response.
Might be too late.
It might be too late for the first blow, but like you said, any attack on North Korea is going to take a while. And, you know, for example, if we were to do that, you can imagine the calls from the UN to have a ceasefire. And China could support, it could leak intelligence to the North Koreans, a lot of things it could do.
What if the first strike merely took Kim out? What if he was just the target?
I understand. One lead bullet, in theory, could do the trick, but it isn't clear that would make a difference. It might lead to someone else stepping up and taking power who is more rational. That's a big risk. We would like to think that there are two or three generals that maybe the Chinese or even we're talking to, but I'm not aware of any evidence of that.
When we were planning to overthrow Castro during the Kennedy administration, we were working with a Cuban general who was right next to Castro all the time. And I've got to believe we've got that same thing out there.
You know, I'm not convinced of that, George. First off, Castro, of course, had only recently assumed power. The Kims have been there for a very long time. And the other thing is they have what's often called the dead hand. And I'm sure Kim has arranged this. If something goes wrong with him or his immediate cadre, a lot of things can happen. Allegedly, they'll give the order to slaughter all the people in their concentration camps. Maybe they'll launch a dead hand retaliation. The artillery pieces we're concerned about on the hitting Seoul and our troops. So it's not clear that just taking him out would solve the problem.
Let's go to Marcel in London, Ontario, in Canada on the wildcard line. Hello, Marcel. Go ahead.
Yes, George. I see only one way out of this North Korea situation.
And that would be?
There's only one power who could shut down North Korea's nuclear program, and that is China. And if anybody hasn't guessed yet, China is using North Korea to intimidate its neighbors, Japan, Taiwan, South Korea, because they're having territorial disputes.
Yep.
And China wants to control the entire China Sea. So if they went ahead and tried to take those territories, North Korea is leveraged that the United States not get involved. So the only way to shut down North Korea's nuclear program is by the United States threatening to give Japan, South Korea, Taiwan nukes. Now, they don't actually have to give them nukes, but as long as it's perceived by China that those countries will have nukes, then real talks can begin.
Interesting, Bart. He's right, and we would possibly consider giving nukes to a country that attacked us for World War II, that we nuked.
I understand, but several things. First off, there are other ways. In principle, for example, we might be able to pull off a massive shock and awe cyber attack and simply shut that system down while we did other things. So So that's one thing we could do. And it is the case that there is an argument, has been for a long time, that Taiwan can make the same argument North Korea. North Korea's argument is, we need nukes because we're facing a hostile U.S. invader. Taiwan can say, we need nukes because we're facing, literally than they are, a hostile People's Republic of China invader. And they did have a nuclear program. And President Reagan's administration talked the Taiwanese out of that. I think it's highly improbable we would start that. It's possible, of course, politically, but can you imagine the uproar of giving nukes? Now, on the other hand, Japan, on its own, can, despite that terrible history of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, it has so much high-grade plutonium because it has so many reactors that it could quite easily create a formidable arsenal of nuclear weapons. And I don't think they'll do that yet, but it's the sort of thing that we hear about now. I don't think that's practical. I think the gentleman is correct, Marcel's right, that in theory China could stop it or slow it down just by squeezing the economic spigot. But there's no real sign of that other than some fairly, I should say, token sanctions that they're perhaps going to help us enforce after the new UN resolution.
Here's the other thing, Bart. You know, I know we control the South, and the Russians and the Chinese control the North right after World War II, after Japan occupied Korea. Why can't we get along with people? Why do we happen to have enemies? Why would the North be so upset with us? And why aren't we cutting deals with them, saying, look, we're going to bring you food, we're going to take care of your people, we need to be friends? Just like the Russians and the Chinese are.
It's a great question. You know, in theory, there's something in economics called the Coase theorem that says you can always bargain your way out of a problem, in effect, and why can't we bargain our way out of this one? And it's not clear. I mean, the North Koreans have been in power for a long time, a dynastic regime. It's not clear they'd want to give that up. And we did do that in some sense, George. We made many peace offerings, all administrations. There's no, I think, real president to blame here. But the desire to get weapons, not just nuclear weapons now, and again, they detonated an H-bomb. You really want to underscore that and put an exclamation mark, an H-bomb. But also, they apparently have stockpiles of sarin gas, VX gas, and who knows what else.
They probably do.
Yeah, another way to think about it, as the founder said, if men were angels, we'd have a very different form of government. But if even 1-5% of men are devils or potentially devils, well, we have more of our current form of government.
Mm-hmm. That's so true. Well, I it's just that you would think that people could work things out regardless of the horror that Kim has brought on his own nation and the butchery that they do. You know, if I were President Trump, I'd invite the guy over to the United States and say, "Lay, let's talk this out."
I understand. And my understanding is he, at some point, apparently said to Saddam Hussein, "See, I told you that if you don't have a nuclear weapon, they'll invade you." Or at least that's the apocryphal story.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe if we hadn't done the Iraq invasion, which turned out to be a fiasco, maybe if we hadn't done that, things like that, and what happened with Gaddafi when he gave up his missiles, you know, it ended very badly, and you can see a YouTube video of that. So I think we have not helped our cause in that regard. I think he's looking at the facts. I think Kim is, as President Trump called him, a very sharp cookie.
You got it. Bart, we're going to come back and take final calls with you next on Coast to Coast AM. Bart Costco with us, and we're going to take final calls with Bart when we come back in a moment. Next hour, Lynn McTaggart joins me as we talk about her latest work, The Power of Eight. Wait till you hear what she has to say. But we'll come back and take final calls in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Oh, we are back with final calls with Bart Costco. And again, several of his books include The Fuzzy Future, Noise, Heaven in a Chip. Heaven in a Chip, that was one of the first books, Bart, wasn't it?
It was a late 90s book, yeah. And the idea there is that when we can replace at least part of your brain with a computer chip, if not completely back it up with one. By the way, what's the great flaw of the brain? It has no backup.
No backup.
Trying to fix that. But it'll take a while to get there. But if we can do that, George, to the extent we can, then a lot of your experiences would be like what we describe heaven as, almost a kind of omniscience. You could achieve things simply by thinking of them. You omnipotence, I should say, omniscience. You could access databases at the speed of light. You could mix and mind meld with others and a truly new form of consciousness and so on. And moreover, it would happen in what I call nanotime, which is also the name of a different novel. But and that is to say, in the time we're speaking right now, in a few seconds of human time, which is based on the slow processing of our neurons in our brain and our neural system, you would have instead centuries, perhaps, of when you're speeded up that fast and living in a computer chip. So one of the properties of heaven is eternity. We can't achieve that in this physical universe as far as we know. We can do a pretty good engineering approximation if we can get that chip to back up all a part of the brain.
Remember the great baseball player Ted Williams? His head is being kept in a cryogenic chamber, cool down, and one day they're hoping to clone his body and to download his memory from his head. And there he is again.
That's right. Now, first off, it's cryonics. Full disclosure, I have every intention of ending up the same place Ted is at, and that is at the Alcor facility, where I am a science advisor.
Okay.
It's an unpaid position. And by the way, Alcor, the main cryonics outfit in the world, is a nonprofit. There's been a lot of confusion. But you're absolutely right. One approach to this, there's many, is, in effect, if you could replicate the brain on a computer chip, since the main structure that we're talking about and the AI structure is in the synapses, and that does persist beyond simple biological death. If you can replicate that, and then in principle you could clone a body back for that if you wanted. But what I just said offers a different approach. If it's the case that you're coming back in a computer chip, George, or something like that, do you really want to be trapped in a kind of slow prison of flesh? I mean, we're talking about operating on orders of magnitude greater speeds than we currently do. But the main thing is on the Ted Williams approach, and people like me and others, you'd be surprised, by the way, who are actually signed up for cryonic suspension. But the main thing is...
It's worth a story.
Yeah, exactly. But the main thing is, again, the brain has no backup, and we'd like to have at least some shot at that. Now, the technology is not there, but every day it gets better, and when you're, as we say, doing time in a bottle of liquid nitrogen, time is on your side. It doesn't matter whether it takes a century or a millennium, whatever it takes, until science catches up. It's a gamble a few of us are willing to take.
Do you think in the future that they will literally be able to download memory from a human brain onto a chip of some type?
Sure. Sure.
Wow.
We have colleagues at USC right now who are working on the very difficult problem, of porting, of getting from brains to chips. That's the main bottleneck. The power of the chips right now are getting closer and closer to the brain. You can do a quick calculation, but the brain's operating on the order of about 10 to the 18 bits of operations per second, which is pretty fast, and it's all done in parallel. Well, our computers will greatly outstrip that. So the hard thing is doing the porting back and forth, and to get the kind of nano tendrils in the brain. Remember, one of the great things about the brain, George, is there are no bones in it. So a lot of things you can take advantage of that.
Yeah.
But to back it up, and if, for example, if your computer stops or have problems, you have a system restore on that. You can go back to earlier. Wouldn't you like to have a system restore from 3 months ago or 10 years ago? It'll take a while to get there, but doing this does not break a law of physics, doesn't violate the speed of light.
It's not unethical, right?
And I don't think it's at all unethical. Your most precious information, you, it's not in your foot, George. It's in your brain. And we have a system that doesn't back that up. I think we're going to fix that. And whether it happens in your lifetime or mine isn't clear, but I think with high probability within the next century.
Let's go to Virginia Beach, Virginia, east of the Rockies. Michael's with us. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning, George. And quickly... Dr. Kosko, how do you spell your last name?
K-O-S-K-O.
Yeah. Okay. In 16 and a half years ago, when you were on this show with Art Bell, I got you to admit that there's a high probability that there's an intelligent life somewhere else in this universe. Now,
Let's apply that.
By the way, it's not an omission. It's something I would gladly concede. It's a usual consequence of looking at the probabilities involved in the so-called Drake's equation.
Yes, yes. We talked about that then. But I want to apply that to the North Korean situation and to the uniqueness of what George Norrie has brought to radio since 2001. This is a multidimensional problem. This is not two-dimensional chess that we are playing with the North Koreans. Now, George had a man on in the early 2000s, 2002, 2005, somewhere in there. His name was Burgess. I can't remember if that was his last name or his first name. But he revealed something on this station that I've never heard anywhere else. He said that Nixon went to China because and opened up trade with China because China was blackmailing us. They were threatening to fake an attack which would cause the United States and Russia to go at war with each other and leave China untouched. Now, there are 180 million Christians in China. I have a bargaining chip, and the bargaining chip is this. They've been hiding. They've been hiding for decades, and we are now ready to take over China, just as we have done in Russia. And that's why Mr. Trump has got to talk to Mr. Putin, because Mr. Putin knows that the Christians are going to take over.
Interesting take. And that was Bruce Burgess, by the way, Michael, a filmmaker at that time, years, years ago. Go ahead, Bart.
A couple of things. About the China-Nixon connection, I would have suspected something that would have leaked by now by the Henry Kissinger types or others. I'm not aware of any evidence of that. And it's hard to believe that a nuclear exchange between the U.S. and Russia back then would not have had an effect on China. But I do want to say, agree with you about George here. George, I think you do have a remarkable show, and I mean this. You achieve what we call in the law a meeting of minds, and I applaud you. I mean, I not only enjoy being a guest, I'm happy to be a listener of this program. It's just too little of that where people actually think. You are one of the most open-minded men I've ever met, to the extent that I've met you digitally, and I can only applaud you.
Well, thank you, Bart. I appreciate that. We've got a great staff that does the yeoman's work here, and I'm fortunate enough to have them with me. Matter of fact, I was in the iHeart Music Festival this weekend with our corporate people. They are amazed that we haven't had any staff turnovers since the beginning that we've been doing this show, you know, going on 14, 15 years now. It's unheard of. It's a great, great team. I mean, truly a great team. Back to Michael, thank you, by the way. Let's go to Gordon in Lakeland, Florida. Welcome to the program. Hi, Gordon.
Yeah, George and Dr. Costco, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
As a longtime caller, I want to just echo that you're one of the most fair radio hosts that actually will listen to me and not just bully me or use me as some pawn or something. And I'm not going to name names, but there are good ones and bad ones, and I would say you're one of the best. Now, Dr. Costco, you were mentioning earlier about how noise can help. Now, I'm going back to the truckers. I'm a CB radio enthusiast. I would give local information to truckers, and I'm a ham radio, in other words, an amateur extra. And we typically think of noise as never good. The only exception I could possibly think is if you have a single sideband and it sounds like Donald Duck and someone throws a dead carrier out there, just a key, a dead key with only the wave. It can ride it, and it'll sometimes help. But noise typically is only bad. For example, I would get up and turn my air conditioner off, but I'm lazy. I mean, let's be politically correct, energy efficient. The call screener is excellent, and he rightly asked me to turn off the radio and other things. And the air conditioner in the background is, I don't know if you can hear it, but my AC is on in my room. That's noise. And I never think of noise as helping the signal. Well, maybe one other exception, if you have your squelch on and the signal's not strong enough, any noise that breaks the squelch would help. But how can noise be something that would help the signal intelligence get through as opposed to hurting it?
I'll be happy to tell you, Gordon. And you kind of touched on it by amplifying the signal. And this is very common in music CDs. We actually deliberately add noise to music CDs to make it sound better. If the simplest kind of noise boost is called dithering. It's not what I was talking about before for AI algorithms. But in dithering, which is very common in signal processing, and this is for nonlinear systems, let's suppose we have something that wiggles, if your audience can picture what we call a sine wave, and you're trying to get the wave above a high bar and the fall below a low bar, but it's not energy intensive enough. But if you add noise to the wiggling thing, enough noise, it'll pop up over the high bar and below the low bar. So noise can, in that sense, energize low-energy signals. In nature, as I discuss at length in my book, Noise, and you see some of the papers on my website, nature has figured this out. So many creatures, from crickets to crayfish and others, and it looks like it's ubiquitous, actually, in mammals, use noise to enhance some of their signal-detecting systems that are nonlinear. By the way, I want to say also, George, while I'm at it, one of the many reasons I enjoy coming on your program is to announce new work. I am bringing out a large quantity of new research in artificial intelligence.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of that is patented through USC, and a lot of it is open source, so to speak, but I post that on my webpage at USC under the journal articles, and there's a new article there now, and it'll be the first of many to come, that completely reformulates modern fuzzy logic in terms of probability in a quite radical way. So interested listeners can download that as they please. But stay tuned, there'll be a lot more in the upcoming years.
It is amazing. How did you get interested in all this?
I don't know, but I've been interested for a long time, but I do remember standing in high school graduation line, George, back there in Kansas, where I'd worked at a Dairy Queen, and my physics teacher, who I was at a town called Lansing, very close to Fort Leavenworth, and my physics teacher was a colonel in the Army, was working on his PhD, and he sneaked me a copy of a book called The Dragons of Eden, a graduation line. I still have it. He says, if the need arises, here's some food for thought, by Carl Sagan, subtitled Speculations on the Origins of Human Intelligence. And that was the first time for me reading Sagan's book, and having learned something about physics and computers, I really started to think about that and what it meant. And then before long, studying logic, and one thing led to another. But it was really after that, looking at logic and trying to figure out what I really meant by the sentences I wrote or what I said or what I thought. What do I really mean by the word cool in the sense of cool air?
Yeah.
You know, and that's an ongoing problem. And the use of multi-valued or fuzzy techniques for me was revolutionary, and I think it will be also for AI. I would put it this way. The future of AI is fuzzy.
It is fuzzy indeed. And what keeps driving the increase of AI? Who's responsible for it? The human, or is the computer helping it?
Computers do help implement it, but it's still people like me with pieces of chalk and long walks in the mountains and deserts. I should also say, your listeners may find of interest, one of the ways to further boost the AI algorithms, what's about to happen, is what's called quantum machine learning and quantum AI. And what happens there using quantum techniques, you can, for example, if you go to my webpage, I published the first paper that showed how to use noise to improve quantum communication. But that's not what I'm talking about, and I do have with USC a new patent under application that uses noise to improve a quantum search technique. But quantum machine learning techniques in general can literally exponentially speed up through a kind of radical parallelism all the algorithms out there in AI. The downside so far, it's just difficult to get data into the algorithm and to get it out, unlike with the classical system, where that's the easy part and the hard part's the throughput crunching. But that's a revolutionary thing coming. We already have very simple quantum computers, and indeed we have a D-Wave computer at USC.
Let's go to Harry in Port Huron, Michigan, Wildcard Line. Hi, Harry, go ahead.
Hey, guys, thank you very much. I guess one thing that concerns me tonight is there's been a lot of fear expressed, and I'm not saying that, you know, that everything's perfect with AI and everything is, and you know, in North Korea we shouldn't take any precautions, et cetera. But, guys, life is a series of risks. I'm a disabled man. I take risks every day. I take risks all the time. And if you don't take risks, because you're always afraid of something, we're never going to progress as a as a society or as a world. As I told Tom on the phone, I said earlier, I said in the 1930s and late 1920s, or in the 1900s early, about planes, if we wouldn't have taken risks because we were, everybody was afraid of planes crashing. Remember, people were afraid of...
Oh, yeah. They thought they'd plunge from the sky.
If we wouldn't have taken those risks, we wouldn't be where we are now with transportation, and we can even go further with transportation than we have. But we need to not be afraid as much and take more risks in life. This country is starving for heroes, is starving for people who will take a risk, is starving for leadership.
Give me a quick example on, Harry, the risk you would take.
Well, for example, when I cross the street every day, I cross the light to go where I have to go every day. And I have to trust that those cars aren't going to hit me. I have to trust that somebody's not going to hit me when they make a right on red.
Yeah.
But am I going to stand on the curb and say, my God, I'm afraid I can't cross the street? If I do that, I would never get to where I'm going. We need desperately people who will take risks. We need risk takers. People are starving for that.
Well,
I see it all.
If I can add, I think there's no dispute about that. You want to take risks, but there are two main distinctions in risks. There are those risks you can calculate and those you can't. And the way we formally put it, the kind you can calculate are those which you reasonably know the probabilities of the different outcomes. But often the real world, and this is what we're facing in places like Korea, we don't know all those probabilities, and that's known as uncertainty. That's a much more dangerous thing, and when you combine that kind of uncertainty, not just risk, but with the kind of potential downside here, what we know we call the expected loss, that could involve easily a million lives in South Korea and elsewhere, massive cyber attacks in this country, I think we want to be extremely prudent in taking risks or walking into that veil of uncertainty.
I think so, too. You know, it's like jumping off a cliff. Do you want to measure how deep the water is and what's underneath before you jump? I would. Wouldn't you?
Absolutely.
Time for one more? Nope, I don't think so. The clock is ticking, ticking, ticking. Okay, Bart's website is linked up at coasttocoastam.com. It's tied into USC, so definitely paste it and make it one of your favorites, and you can go to it quite often. His books are still available on Amazon and some bookstores as well. Bart, let's not let 7 years go by next time.
We won't. Happy to be here, George. We'll do it again soon.
Okay, my friend. Bart Cusco. Fuzzy Logic. Now, up next, Lynn McTaggart. We're going to go live to London. The Power of Eight. Harnessing the miraculous energies of a small group to heal others, your life, and the world. Boy, we need one of these right now, don't we?